beautiful. I mean, it shows you what it was like to live with Sam. I mean, because Monsieur kind of worked on this book for 35 plus years in his heart. You know, I mean, he kept a journal, and he'd gone through a lot of changes during the time that Mercer was alive. And I mean, you know, but he stuck with it in his heart, and I think it's great. I mean, what came out of it is a picture of an extraordinary human being. I mean, it's comparable to the material you see on the daily life of Ramakrishna, or the journals that were kept in Ananda Ashram around what Mother Krishnabai and Papa Ramdas were doing, because it's a daily journal. But I mean, that gives it its power, because Monsieur was keeping a daily journal, and so then when he was choosing to write about this particular period, he's writing about himself and his process, but he's got all his memory about all the details of what Sam did that day, plus all the correspondence, because he was writing. You know, he wrote more letters than anybody of his generation. I mean, I would hate to imagine what would have happened in the age of emails and the internet, because it was always, you know, make three copies and send one to Senator so-and-so and this person and that. I mean, he was just, you know, every morning he'd wake up and write to Art Hoppe, you know, the humor columnist in the San Francisco Chronicle, or Stanton Delaplane or somebody. You know, and so Monsieur had track of the letters of those days, the copies of them, and then also what was going on, and then, you know, plus his own experience being a disciple and trying to work through his many changes. You know, his life was blowing up in his face, you know, in a lot of ways. And, you know, so it's fascinating at many different levels. But it reveals beyond mind what it's like to be in the presence of a real challenging energy that is totally dedicated to God realization, but not at all attached to how it might be viewed. Sam really didn't care whether you thought he was great or not so great. Shabu said, you kind of because you'd gotten so much from being around him, you kind of wished, you know, to introduce your friends to him, and, you know, people, you know, because, but you never knew, you know, what he might do, you know. I mean, he might really make a terrible impression on you. But after a while, you came to understand that, to him, it was the same whether he made a good impression or a bad impression, because he was, you know, deep in his energy was this dedication to God, and he was bringing forward that vibration. And it, so it really didn't matter, because over the years, a lot of the people that he made a terrible impression on, I remember coming back around in different ways, and they just always remembered him and said, you know, that guy, you know, I mean, there's something about him stuck with him. And it was because he was living from that place of great dedication, great heart, great representation of the divine reality in embodiment. I mean, his teaching was about embodiment. He got this, all these hippies, which was us. You know, I mean, we had these various experiences and openings on psychedelics, and some of it just by, you know, being in the atmosphere of what was happening in our age. And but, you know, quite a number of us were way up here in the heavens. And Sam, you know, I mean, his job was to stay on Earth. I mean, the easiest thing for him to do was to get high. You know, I mean, all he had to do was just, you know, turn loose of that sense of, and he was there, you know. So, I mean, that's why, I mean, when he would do a practice, it would be like, you do a meditation, it'd be a few seconds, and you say, okay, you know, I mean, that was it. You know, bring your mind to it right away. Bring your attention right here. I mean, and he didn't give a lot of long practices, but he gave you that sense of deep quickening of heart. You know, you can catch it in the twinkling of an eye, and he was always there, believing that he was there, giving it in that twinkling of the eye by the grace of God. And so, I mean, it was incredible. Because for all of his very human faults, you know, because he didn't try to hide them, you know, sometimes, you know, you could just see. I mean, he grew up a wounded person. I mean, he grew up a being who was, his mother had dreams of the prophet Samuel before he was born. She was of the Rothschild of banking family. And his father was Jacob Strauss, who was an executive in the Levi Strauss company. As Sam said, his parents never forgave him for being conceived out of wedlock. Which is funny. He had a terrible family situation. They didn't talk to each other. His mother and his father for years didn't talk to each other. When the mother wanted to talk, say something to the father, and they're all sitting at the table, she'd tell Samuel, she said, "Samuel, tell your father so-and-so." And when the father wanted to tell the mother something, he'd say, "Jacob," who was the younger brother, "tell your mother so-and-so." I mean, it was one of those very strange situations. He was a totally introverted person. He had the inner sense of the divinity, when he met his Sufi teacher, Hazrat Inayat Khan, his heart was opened. And so he had that loyalty his whole life to that sense, of having his heart open, someone who could embrace him and see him, in the depth of his being, as sacred and divine. And that's the teaching of Sufism. We can open deeply enough, we'll see God within the heart of each one of us, and each one is totally sacred and divine and will manifest in a unique way. And Sam Lewis claimed his uniqueness, and his life was very full of joy and full of service. He worked really hard trying to help people. Paul Reps, who many people know because he collected Nyogen Senzaki sayings in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which became kind of a cult classic. And he was an old friend of Sam's and also a disciple of Inayat Khan along with him. And, when I was interviewing him about Sam, he said, "One thing you have to know about Sam is he was going to help you." I mean, he had that intention of helping people. I mean, it was so deep that whatever he was doing was in, he had that intention of somehow being of service, somehow being of real help for people's awakening, for humanity to feed people, to meet the problems of inequality and all the rest of it, to share seeds. I mean, so he just embodied it. He brought us hippies down. He had the magnetism to bring us down. The dances are magnetic in themselves. You're holding hands. You're doing music and sound, your rhythm, and you're bringing vibration down into the body, right down into this plane. "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Everything's fine in heaven. We got to bring all of that holy vibration right into our relationships and lives and bodies. And Sam modeled that in his own unique way. So I'm always happy to celebrate his birthday. I went to a number of birthdays with him, and he liked to have a good time.
Like, what kind of a time did he have? You guys were laughing.
Well, he liked to have people. He didn't like parties where people got together and everybody just talked to themselves,
I know I don't tolerate those well either.
He'd say, he tolerated for a little while, and he said, "Where's the program? When are we going to do something?"
Sounds like Morale.
He wanted to do some zikr, some dancing, or some, do something, play some games together. Relate to each other as a group, draw the energy together, have a celebration.
I do have a story about when... having friends come, because this is Kalma, just came from the East Coast. She's got a dance circle in Rhode Island. And Mirabai is here from all the way from England, also leads dance over there. So nice to have you both. But before I come to the West Coast, both of us lived at Baba Ram Das's place in New Hampshire. And so we had some friends from there that came out to San Francisco after we were already planted here. And one of them, many of you may know, Abraham Sussman. His name is Roy. And so he came to the... our meetings were never this big, half this size, I would say. And this particular meeting took place... we would meet Sunday night and Monday night at the Mentor Garden for Dharma night, Sunday night, and Monday night was Sufi night. There were other classes too, but we would meet upstairs, and Mercer would give a little talk, and then often we'd go downstairs into the concrete floor, oil-soaked basement for the dances. So it had a small doorway, and invariably somebody who would come in for the first time would feel the power of the energy there, and shyly sit right in the doorway. And the first thing that Mercer would say then is, "Don't sit in the doorway. You know, don't block the doorway."
That was the first thing you ever said to me.
Don't block the doorway. What a koan. Anyway, that does happen to this fellow Roy, and I remember sitting right there, and Mercer was here, you know. And Mercer went around the room when new people came, and he greeted them. You know, he wanted to meet them, and he said to this fellow, "And what's your name?" He says, "Well, my name is Roy Sussman." And he says, "And where are you from?" So at this point, Roy interprets that this is some kind of cosmic test. And so he says, and he thinks about it, he says, "The universe." Mercer says, no, I said, "Where are you from?" And then he comes up with his second answer, you know, "The cosmos." And Mercer now is getting louder. I said, "Where are you from?" Finally, this exchange is in the third or fourth degree, and he's yelling. And I mean, he's, you know, the place is shaking. "I said, where are you from?" He says, "I'm living in my Volkswagen bus." "Well, thank you very much." Then the class went on. You know.
I'm going to tell the story. This is an entertainment story, and then I'm going to do an example of a mini teaching commentary of reading a very little bit that you're not quite sure what he's reading, and then it's over and you've gotten the whole thing. But the story is my first meeting with Mershud Sam, which Shabda actually was quite present, and many people might have heard this before, but I haven't been here for a long time. So we were coming from Ram Dass's, and we were living with Ram Dass in his first year back from, early on in knowing Maharaji and his teacher, and he wore a long white Indian robe, and he had a long gray beard. He was a holy man. I met a holy man, so I knew what holy man looked like because I was hanging out with one. And whenever we'd meet each other in the path at his father's farm where we were all staying in the summer, we would bow and our eyes would meet and we'd get very quiet. We were the first people ever to say Mount Namaste in America. Boy, we've done an every yoga class every day. Anyway, so I knew how a holy man acted too. So then Shabda, it was a time where we were doing the practice of silence, and we would wear little blackboards on little strings, and you know, we were really holy. And we wouldn't talk, but he wrote on his blackboard, and this is all new to me. I was like 22 or something. I'm at Harvard, you know, working at Harvard, and mind. And he says, "Come with me to California to meet a Sufi." And I thought it said Snoopy.
Snoopy. And you came anyway.
Volkswagen bus decorated with Indian princess dress. Almost got run out of the deep south. Anyway, we got to the
so far
door.
It's all through. I hadn't heard the Snoopy part.
The stairs to upstairs, and we've been traveling in this Volkswagen bus for a long time by now, right? And I had, you know, left my whole promising active life in Cambridge and then come out to where, California. I've never been there. And at the top of the stairs, as we came downstairs, as I recall it, now I'm well able to admit that some of us who are getting older find that memory kind of morphs a little. So we may not remember exactly correctly, but the essence is true from my experience. At the head of the stairs was a little man who had his sweater buttoned wrong,
He frequently did, yeah.
And his socks were kind of hanging down. I don't remember they matched. And his beard looked like he hadn't combed it for a long time. He had these big black glasses on. And he had holes in the arms of one of the sleeves. And he didn't say, Namaste. Go in the front room, I'll be with you in a minute. Well, I looked at Shelby. I didn't say this aloud, but I thought,
I'd already met Mercy, so I was coming back. You know, it had drawn me back.
Yeah.
And I said, "Come with me." And so, and now this was the moment of meeting.
Yes, you know, and I thought he believed him. It was somebody really special. But I'm thinking, what?
What a mistake!
Who are these Snoopies anyway?
Something about going to the front room. I'm going to be dictating something to Wally Ollie. But I thought he said, forgive me, Wally. I don't know if you've heard the thing. I thought he said, roly poly.
Were you on any substances at this time?
We didn't touch sugar or drugs. I remember burying my marijuana before I went into Ram Dass because that was a no-drug scene. Burying outside the ground. Never went back for it. Anyway, probably all feel there now. we had learned Hinduism. Of course, I thought I knew everything because I was 22. And one thing was Ramakrishna had always said, you know, holy people don't touch wine, women, politics, money. You know, there were a lot of neti, you know, don't touch things, you know. And so this one, there in the back room, I could hear this loud-voiced man dictating a letter about politics. Well, holy people don't go into politics. So by then I was sort of thinking, he should drive me all the way across the country to meet this total fake. This fake. And then we had dinner, and he took us in for dinner, and he didn't eat sattvic food. He put ketchup on everything. And we were from this Hindu thing where you eat the very purest food and you make long prayer before. And we were really sincerely into this, and it was very useful training, actually, at a certain level in time. So by then, I was sure he was a complete fraud. But he said, stay, we're having a class downstairs, which was in a garage. It was really a garage with tie-dyes on the wall. And I hadn't done the California hippie thing. I'd done the East Coast beatnik thing. We were intellectually advanced. So into this room down there.
I was a California hippie even when I lived in the East Coast. Never very advanced.
Yeah. And in walked it all these beautiful, long-haired, robed, floating hippies, male and female. They all had long hair. They were all, like, glowing. And I thought, wow, what are all these beautiful, cool people doing with this fraud? And then he started leading one thing. What he used to do was lead us chanting Om Mani Padme Hum. Now, at Ram Dass, going backward to that time, we would early in the morning gather and we would chant before the sun came up. And we knew how to do Om Mani Padme Hum, I guess, you know. And then he led a snake dance. And then whether it was Allah or Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And I was in this line of holding hands with people. And my critical mind, Virgo moon resistance, was sort of melting away. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And all of a sudden, my heart feeling this feeling of so much love. And it starts opening up. And there seems like to be light everywhere. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And I'm so in love with this little old man that I will follow him anywhere for the rest. rest of this life at least. I think that's enough for now.
Ah. Well, I grew up immersed in mystical tradition in Christianity, and then had the opportunity to study Zen Buddhism, and also study in a rigorous way with Swami Satchidananda, and as a very young woman, and never felt satisfied. There wasn't any connectivity to everyday life that was palpable. And so I was really hungry for something that was going to work in everyday life, a path of mysticism that was woven into my life as a woman, my life as a student, my life with my partner, my life on the street, and that's what led me into Sufism. So I didn't know Murshid Sam in the body, and the first person I did meet, and I was searching with my partner at the time, a person many of you know, Sheikh Ishaq, who has passed to the land of the ancestors. First person we met was Shahabuddin Less, and really blessed opportunity there in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. We were both students at Columbia University, and and so there we were, Cathedral of St. John the Divine. Nobody was there. Huge stone cathedral. There's like maybe 8 people dancing. And so we're dancing and just coming into this state of ecstasy. We're turning and someone, big man, just, we're spinning, clubs me right in the nose. Oh. And my stars are just going. Oh my God, my nose is broken. Tears are running down my face. And yet, you know, I can still, Shahabuddin just keeps on going and I can see the twinkle still in his eyes. And just, okay, this is a real thing. So that was the beginning. It led me to meet Moina Dean and Wali Ali and Shabda and Tamam and all of those early students of Murshid Sam just a few months after this big punch in the nose. And again, everywhere that I would find these people, I would find this sparkle, as well as something that was palpably, for me anyway, authentic, that worked in everyday life.
Like a punch in the nose.
Like a punch in the nose, yeah. So that's one of the things that I so love about Murshid. And love and feel so grateful for our work together is that it's very practical. Our practices, our dancing, they take us here. How do we live together? How do we relate together? How do we serve each other? So I just wanted to share this evening what Murshid says is the first poem he ever wrote at the age of 22, and I'm just going to move over here so I can actually read it. And I know many of us are gardeners, and Murshid was a gardener, so he really had an understanding of the elements, not only the elements outside of himself, but also the garden of the heart and the elements that make up the human structure. wrote this in 1919 at age 22. And here we all are, the garden. To me hath been granted a garden, though only for my care, to nourish the plants and flowers that may be growing there. 'Twas God that granted this garden, for only the other day, the owner, my neighbor, left it to use it as I may. And dahlias shall grow in the garden, and roses of beauty rare, and daisies and tulips and daffodils, and of poppies and lilies fair. Yes, there shall be many flowers, but not alone will they grow, but beauty and love and hope and truth, these also shall I sow. And fairies shall play in the garden, sylphs and elves and gnomes, and birds shall sing there all day long and make their summer homes. Yes, and bees shall gather their honey and toil there all the day, whilst I shall gather the flowers, for that is all my pay. And what shall be done with the flowers is the question you may ask, for after all, they'd only be a reward for my daily task. To God will have grown these flowers, and to God shall they be given, and I but the steward in that backyard for our Father, Mother, who art in heaven. There'll be some for the poor and lowly, and some for those sick in bed, and others for those in hospitals and for the children whose parents are dead. And so shall all the flowers be a hope for all those whose life is shut from the beauties given by God, who are lost in this world of strife. And everywhere in this garden that God has granted me shall love be planted and grow, and I, the servant, be. And for the blossoms that come there, a message each shall bring, beauty and love and joy and hope. And every flower shall sing.
Oh.
Amen.
Amen. So, Wally Ollie did talk about a book, but you might not know what he was talking about. So, Wally Ollie became Mercer's esoteric secretary, but in a period before that, a man named Monsieur Johnson served as a secretary and attendant. And he had the wisdom to be a chronicler. He took photographs. He recorded Mercer. He wrote down his diary notes. All of ours, which were recorded here, he had a record of. And so he started writing this book shortly after Mercer died. And then it was 1,000 pages, and then it was this, and then it was this. And 3 years ago, he sent me a disc of it. And, you know, he wasn't really that good at computers. It was like one of those old floppy disks. Even at that time, I had to find some way to read it because it was hard to find the reader for him. And so I printed the whole thing out at Kinko's and read it through and gave it to a few other people. And I said, let's get this thing published. And then Murshid Saadi worked on it. And I think you'll love it. I thought it was fantastic. It's very earthy. Now, I don't know if you'll love it, because I read it. It's like, you know, home stories, home, and your mom and your dad, you know, so it's all in there. I want you to all order it and then let me know if it's like pretty good, not bad, excellent, you know. So I thought I'd just read a few passages from it just to give you a flavor.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Mershid. And this is a pic. I don't know if you can see. I'm right here in the dark part of the room. But
it's a picture of him standing. Mansour and Mershid took a ride in his Volkswagen van. It might have been Saul.
And Saul also, yeah.
Saul, up by Mount Shasta. And so it has a picture of Mount Shasta in the back, Mershid standing, and there's a locomotive kind of coming with its light beam. So that's one of his. There's many, many photos in here you haven't seen.
You know, he went in his archives and think, oh, let's see. And so they're in here too. You just want to get it for the pictures. It's okay. So this is kind of in his introduction. So I'm just going to skip right into the introduction. In 1965, I married Carolyn Buckmaster, whom I met while accumulating 60 hours towards a... That's a Taj.
Mansoor married.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is Mansoor speaking. Thank you. A PhD in English at the University of Iowa. Mostly I was enrolled to stay out of the war in Vietnam. After my wife had a baby in 1966, that's Nathan for those of you who know, I dropped out and taught English at Northern Michigan University for 1 year. I named the boy Nathan B. Johnson. With two college degrees, a wife and family, I felt old at 26. The questions that consumed me at the time were simple. What to do? How to live? I'd taken LSD once in Mexico and experienced the oneness of life. This was a religious experience for me. My friends and I craved the experience and experimented with other psychedelic drugs. Among those friends from Iowa City were Carl and Pat Jablonski, that's one of the in Fatima, who moved to San Francisco. They shared the ambience of the hippie explosion with us in Michigan. I especially remember a recording of the human being in Golden Gate Park with music and speakers like Allen Ginsberg and Timothy Leary. Then, when they met Murshid, Carl told me Murshid's message was, joy without drugs, and it struck a chord. Sufism is based on experience, Murshid said. Very well, drug-induced mysticism was our experience. We yearned for more, and we needed guidance. We thought Murshid could take us where we wanted to go fastest. I resigned my position in Michigan. So there we were in 1967, 1 month after Murshid moved to 410 Presida in San Francisco. My wife and I celebrated Independence Day, July 4th, in his living room with the Jablonskis. To Murshid, we were young people. Murshid was 71 years old. The Vietnam War and the hippie phenomena associated with the Haight-Ashbury district in San Francisco were nothing to me after this meeting with Murshid. His two-bedroom townhouse with a one-car garage facing Presida Park in the Mission District became my school. And little by little, the living room above the garage filled up with students. Murshid was retired and lived on a small inheritance, so he was free to tend to those of us he was attracting. So that gives you kind of a... It's supposed to be there. We go. Jamila and I join Murshid for dinner at Pat and Carl's in Bolinas. Jamila says to Murshid, when you're around, our husbands don't know what they're doing. Otis cleaned the house today before you came. Murshid answered, how do you know he didn't know what he was doing?
Yeah.
Okay. I used to get into my third eye by inhaling. Tonight, driving into the meeting, I get into my third eye by exhaling. At the meeting, when I concentrate on Murshid speaking, I lose consciousness of my body to some extent. Invariably, my joined hands lose feeling. I understand what Murshid says about being restricted by his disciples. He says he can soar only as high as they are able to go. Why? Because he must be with them. Where they are, he must be. Murshid says a Gatha, Sufi study paper class, will be coming up and starting in Bolinas. He predicts the realizations are inevitable for some of us at certain tombs in Pakistan, but does not mention his own powerful experiences in Lahore, Pakistan, at the tomb of Al-Hujwiri, Dadagang Baksh. Of this he wrote, on every occasion when visiting the shrine, the saint appeared. Something just amazing happened in Japan. Murshid's own words. I'll skip over that. This is the beginning of a chapter. This is Murshid Sam's words. As one was visiting the tomb of Amir Khusro, that's the great Indian poet, musician, saint, Amir Khusro invented the Urdu language, the sitar, the tabla, was the poet laureate of India and the disciple of Nizamuddin Aliya. One day when I was visiting the tomb of Amir Khusro at the Nizamuddin Aliya complex in New Delhi, in company with Piro Murshid Hasan Sani Nizami, the poet Khusro appeared. He's from, I should have said he's a 12th century saint. Yeah. A 13th century, excuse me. The poet Khusrow, he appeared. Open daylight mushahida, contemplation, and put a robe around one and said, I appoint you successor to Muhammad Iqbal in the school of Jalaluddin Rumi. Muhammad Iqbal was a great Sufi poet of just a recent previous time. Jalaluddin Rumi, you know. I appoint you successor to Muhammad Iqbal in the school of Jalaluddin Rumi. When I reached Pakistan, the same robe was ready and is now with me. And as to cosmic poetry, it is already written, and someday, inshallah, God willing, shall be published. And so just to make another note, Murshid wrote an extraordinary poem called Saladin. It's so dense that it's hard to absorb reading it. And Wali Ali, at Alauddin's inspiration, went into the studio and read the whole poem. And there's been music put to it, and it's supposed to be out by December 1st.
Oh, good.
So after you read this book, then you can listen to Wali Ali's recitation. Okay, maybe I'll just read one more part here. This is February 13th, so it's all in diary form, you know, February 10th, February 11th, now February 13th, 1968, Tuesday. Murshid writes to Areste Reza today. As the earlier ecstatic excerpts demonstrate, Murshid's hal, his inspired state of the weekend, continued. He no longer feels constrained from speaking. In the beginning of his letter, Murshid illuminates his experience as a mystic in the first half of the 20th century. Now, this is the part of the excerpt of the letter. There is nothing more horrifying to metaphysical egocentrics than to have mystics come out openly on the same basis as scientists do and relate their experiences. Legends have arisen that if a man knows, he keeps silent. And this has led to a wholesale acceptance of all sorts of persons who are welcomed socially and sometimes also intellectually. And if a man shows any sign to the contrary, he is ipso facto excluded. That means by the fact itself. If we did that in the sciences, we should be in the dark ages. There is no reason or justice before Allah that silence must be kept to please other than Allah. And when Allah speaks, if man obeys, he is immediately accused, and until recently barred absolutely, but no longer, alhamdulillah, praise to God, this is a new age. Okay. I mean, shall we dance?